Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. I'm your girl, Jacqueline, back with another very fun, slightly tumorous episode alongside my co-host, Mr. Mark Ellis. How you doing, sir?
Is that me? Is that how you refer to me? Because
no!
My birth sign, I believe yours is as well. Are we not both? We're actually both cancers. So
we are both cancers.
We have upcoming birthdays, and
yes,
we're very excited about it. We might do a joint birthday celebration. Jacqueline was telling me off air, maybe there's some shenanigans that happen in July. We'll get to that when we get to it. But this is also a very exciting, I will say very non-benign episode of Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong.
Yes, very non-benign episode, but in the best way, because today we're talking about the fan favorite Oscar finalist, Malignant. And we have a guest today who brought this one along, and I cannot wait to get to talk to them about it. But first, let's get down to business. So 76% certified fresh is the score on Malignant. 52% rotten audience score, which is interesting.
So I feel like the critics aren't necessarily wrong. I don't necessarily blame the audience either. So I'm a fan of both parties here with Malignant, although I did enjoy the movie. Jack, do you think Rotten Tomatoes is right or wrong with that 76%?
I think the critics got it right. And I would say, honestly, the audience did too, because I don't think this is a film that most audience people are going to like. Like, if I can divide it up as its will, I enjoyed this. I understand why 76% of critics did it. But I do think that if you are not a horror person, you are just not going to dig this. So, like, I don't even blame those 50% of people to write. So I would say Rotten Tomatoes is right about both. And today we have a guest who is a filmmaker. Honestly, just a fabulous person from what I was able to see from the film. But then I also went on their Instagram and saw even more. We're talking to Peaches Christ, a drag performer and horror filmmaker who just recently did the film All About Evil, starring Natasha Lyonne, who is, I think, the internet's fave right now. Like, she unseated Timothée Chalamet, both of which are out on Shudder and Blu-ray, Natasha and the film. So before we go ahead and dive too deep into exactly what was going on with Malignant, let's get Tim to break down for us what the critics were saying with our favorite segment, 2 Minutes with Tim.
2 Minutes with Tim. Tell us what the critics were saying back then. Ooh, ooh, 2 Minutes with Tim.
Psycho. The Usual Suspects, The Sixth Sense. A great movie twist can send audiences reeling, questioning everything they saw before the big reveal they didn't see coming. For the most part, critics liked the audacity of Malignant, praising it as a movie that starts off as a well-executed genre exercise before taking a major turn. However, the audience was a lot more split. Malignant is certified fresh at 76% on the tomato meter, but it has a 52% audience score. So what did the critics have to say? In a fresh review, Hannah Flint of Empire Magazine wrote, "There's a hodgepodge of ideas going on that don't always seamlessly fit, but Wan's homage to 80s horror and Wallace's fretful performance has a bloody lot of guts." However, in a rotten review, Jude Dry of IndieWire wrote, "When you're taking this many wild turns, it's better to just lean into the fact that you've made a ridiculous horror movie than to try to make a serious drama." The Rotten Tomatoes critics' consensus reads, "Although Malignant isn't particularly scary, director James Wan's return to horror contains plenty of gory thrills and a memorably bonkers twist." So that's Malignant. Let's kick it back to Jacqueline and Mark, neither of whom are named Gabriel. Back to you, folks.
So why don't we go ahead and open up our movie talk section now. Brian, cue the music. Peaches, I just have to ask you, what are your thoughts on Malignant? I think I know, as the horror filmmaker that you are, and how now having seen the film, but tell us, what do you think about it? And welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, my thoughts are that, well, honestly, I was late to the game, which is unusual because usually when something in the horror community is getting a lot of buzz, you know, I check it out. I might be a few months late, but this one I was pretty late. Like, I saw it recently and it blew me away and I was filled with shame over my tardiness to the party. I thought it was brilliant. I think it's amazing. And I think part of the reason that I didn't rush to see it is because I thought I knew what this filmmaker was going to deliver. And I was wrong. You know, this really, really impressed me just for its sheer audacity and originality.
Oh, I love that so much. All right. So let's go ahead and start with this one. Like, let's just go ahead and start with horror in general. Like, I guess you really like horror, but who's your favorite horror filmmaker?
Oh, my favorite horror filmmaker. That's interesting. Usually people say, who's your favorite filmmaker? And so I would say John Waters, because I grew up in Maryland and the discovery of John Waters really changed my life. As much as there are horrific elements in John's films, I wouldn't describe him as a horror filmmaker. So I would have to say Wes Craven. What Wes Craven and, you know, the creation of A Nightmare on Elm Street and then his redefining the genre multiple times, you know. Mm-hmm. I still think that he has not been given the credit he deserves for the meth film, you know, entry, New Nightmare, you know, just kind of leading the way, you know, so many knockoffs, but we don't give him the credit. And of course, you know, Scream was another time that he basically reinvented the genre and, you know, kind of, you know, the success of Scream continues today.
I love that you made the point about Wes Craven's New Nightmare, because it somehow gets lost in the shuffle of all the other Nightmare on Elm Streets, but we get to see the fun Freddy on the surface, but then we also get to see like a darker, like, oh, that's the guy. That's the guy that everybody's really afraid of. And so I think that with James Wan as a filmmaker, and when you watch Malignant, you see elements of that kind of wink and nod to the audience that we know that what we're in for, we know what kind of movie we're making. But I just wonder about the disparity of this movie, because like Jacqueline said, 76% certified fresh on the tomato meter, but it's one of those rare films, especially for horror, I think, where the audience score is much lower. It's only 52%. And so I'm not going to get in my feelings about that. I think that those are two fair numbers. I just thought they would have been reversed, because the whole point of this movie is that we're making an homage to like B movie and like kind of slashers with a twist. So if you're making an homage to a B movie, you can't really expect it to be an A, you know, decades later. But I still am just curious for your take, Peaches, on why the critics would be giving this movie a fresh rating, whereas the audiences would think it's rotten.
Okay, I'm glad that you asked, because I think I know the answer. As a drag queen who's also a long time horror person and have been doing both of these things for over two decades. I mean, I know to look at me, you would never guess it, but I have been in the game a long, long time. Since I have been doing horror and since I have been doing drag, those two things have exploded in popularity. When I started, they were very, very niche. They were both sort of underground subcultures with hardcore fans. And I think James Wan, in many ways, represents a lot of the popularity and the explosion of horror. And he's created some of the most successful and popular horror franchises. And I think he did it. And I'm not going to say anything negative, because I do think he's a talented filmmaker. But I will say this: if he's the horror answer to RuPaul's Drag Race, you know, as far as the popularity goes for drag these days, and as a hardcore punk satanic drag performer, you know, there is part of me that's a little bitter when these things I love so much become so popular. So, Malignant was not for the masses. It was for the horror fans. It was for the horror community. And so you've got critics who understand horror. They understand the roots of horror. They understand camp. They understand where B-movies are. They know what giallo is. And then I think you've got a lot of James Wan fans, for better or worse, who are tuning in. We see the same thing with Drag Race. They tune into someone like me and they go, that's not drag. And it's like, oh, actually, no. It is actually really drag.
Yeah.
You know, the TV version that you're a fan of is just one version of it. And I think with James Wan, in many ways, I really applaud him because I think he said, oh, wait, look, I can do this too. And so in many ways, I actually think the lack of a higher score from the audience, who cares? Yeah. You know, I mean, in some ways, it makes me like it more.
I agree with you on that. I think there's an undercurrent with this one too, which is it is a James Wan movie, but there was a lot of folks he brought into this that were, I would say, not typically people that James Wan collaborated with. Akila Green being the co-writer on this one being one. And I do feel that this film is way more, I don't even know how to say, underground than even James intended when he was bringing it out. But then Warner Brothers marketed it like it was just another part of the James Wan very poppy universe. Like, I don't know. Mark, what about you? Did you remember the marketing for Malignant? Like, did you feel like you got the bait and switch when you finally saw it?
I don't remember the marketing for Malignant. Like, yeah. I can remember the marketing for stuff like The Conjuring or Insidious, like your more sort of mainstream horror movies that Peaches is talking about. But for Malignant, I remember it just appearing one day on streaming. And it was one of those films that came out in theaters the same day it was streaming. And I think that's part of the reason for the less than stellar box office results, because the movie pulled in, I think, $34 million on a budget of $40 million. It probably made that up with whatever streaming measurement you want to calibrate. But I just remember seeing it and like at home and I'm like, oh, okay, I should probably watch this because I like James Wan. I love horror movies. Let's see what this one is. And it did take me for a ride. It took me for a surprise. And just when you think about that low audience score, Jacqueline, I think maybe part of that is that it's a tough first act to watch just from a domestic violence standpoint. And so maybe that's something that audiences just weren't prepared for, particularly with what Peaches was saying with the James Wan movie, where we know we're going to get like, or we think we're going to get ghosts and goblins and ghouls and some sort of haunted house movie. We weren't expecting anything that visceral.
Yeah. Weren't expecting anything that visceral. And you're right. This movie at the beginning is almost, it's almost like an extended version of what they did with Scream and what Alfred Hitchcock did with Psycho, in the sense of like, there is nothing about the beginning of that movie that actually matters other than the scene that you forget about at the very, very beginning when you're seeing that like Gabriel character. Like anything after that does not matter except for the fact she hit her head. Everything else is just a complete bait and switch. And it's actually a technique called, it's this technique, it's almost like lampshading. It's like there's something going on that you focus the audience on, and it is only so that you can tell them information that they won't necessarily grasp as expositional. I don't know, Peaches, you could talk about like the techniques they use in this, because they use so many, like I would say, old school Argento, Cronenberg. I would even say going back to the like the trauma days of horror, like they use so many of those old school sort of plot devices in this one. If you can maybe talk about which ones maybe you liked that they used.
Well, I think that you really brought up the thing that was the most effective for me, you know, and I think as a horror fan, a hardcore horror fan who sort of ingests this stuff and has been for so long and watches a lot, you know, I was tricked. You know, and, you know, I think that that was one of the things that impressed me the most, is I was totally on that journey of storytelling. And, you know, the domestic violence, you know, I thought was going to be a much bigger part of what was going to play out. And the fact that, you know, by the end of the movie, I wasn't thinking about, you know, her being slammed into that wall, you know, and then when it all started to kind of come together, I mean, my jaw was on the floor, like, oh my God. And my heart was racing and I was excited because it worked, you know.
Yeah.
It was like in many ways, there are movies that sometimes feel, I love haunted attractions. I love theme parks. I love, you know, thrill rides. And I feel like this movie, there are some movies that just feel like I'm in a dark ride, or that, you know, I'm having that experience that it's so exciting that I feel like it's all around me. And this movie did that for me. And a big part of it was the storytelling, exactly what you're saying. The bait and switch really worked.
I think I won, Jacqueline. I think I won, because just hearing an expert like Peaches Christ, who makes horror movies for a living, say that it surprised them. Because, like, I always, as our audience knows, I'm a moron when it comes to watching movies and predicting what happens next. And every time there's a horror movie, I know that that first scene is going to mean something later on. And so I sit down and I focus and I'm like, okay, this is going to mean something later. 5 seconds after it's over, I'm just like, I'm just floating in La La Land and I can't remember anything that happened. And so it was just so rewarding for me to be stupid. Like, ignorance was bliss watching this movie, because I was just hanging on for dear life, seeing all the twists and turns that we were taking, and then to have it all wrap up and just to have it validated that I was not the only one who was just trying to play catch up with the movie the whole time, that was actually the intent. This is already, I'm playing with house money at this point, Jack.
Yeah. It is an interesting thing, too, when you look at this movie and its reception, because as much as I like to say that it was a movie that was, like, disliked, the 50% is actually pretty accurate. But what's more accurate within that is it's 50% that feel very strongly. Those 50% are not wishy-washy. There's not people that I think watch the movie Malignant and they're like, you know, I don't know how I feel about that one. No, you know. You know how you feel, like, immediately. Within the first 5 minutes, you probably know how you feel about the movie. And that opinion may change by the time you get to the end. And I think that's the real power of it. The movie immediately makes you, like, have to make a choice on, like, am I in this or not in this? And if you're not in it, I think those people bail out before they ever figure out what the actual movie really ends up being in the end. I don't know if it didn't start so shocking, if it would have been able to hold the twist the way that it does in the end. But Peaches, I'll take it to you. What were your favorite sort of moments from it? Because looking back on it now, besides the fact that I couldn't figure out who that kid was, and I figured out later he was the villain from the first Percy Jackson movie. Seriously, watched that scene 3 times, trying to figure out who that dude was. And I was like, ah, it's the villain. He was Hermes.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and 3-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Other than that, that scene to me is probably one of the best scenes ever in cinema, or like everything in that moment, because it is probably one of the smartest things I've ever seen written for what it does later.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And also, just to piggyback on what you're saying really quick before a favorite scene, you're so right. That 50%, that really, really matters, because that's a 50% of people that didn't passively give it, you know, a thumbs up or a fresh rating. These are passionate people. And as someone who programs cult movies and is in the business of celebrating cult movies, I can tell you that in 20 years, if they screen Malignant, there will be an audience. And very few horror movies coming out today, I can confidently say that in 20, 30, 40 years, you screen this movie and people will show up. So it doesn't sometimes it doesn't matter what the actual percent is, it's how passionate people are about it. And this movie will be kept alive, you know, for decades because of that passion. And then, of course, I mean, I don't know how you feel about spoilers. So I'm going to.
Oh, no, we're a spoiler show. So, like, anybody coming to this, if you haven't seen it, Tough titty, yeah, as my mommy would say.
Wow. Yeah, tough titty. Okay. Well, the best scene, I mean, to me, is just the revelation at the end and the gore effect of the face appearing, like, just when your whole brain is melting, you know, kind of going, oh my God, I did not see that coming. That is so exciting. And, you know, that sort of, you know, the connecting with, like you said, the connecting with that kind of innocuous moment of domestic violence at the beginning that's really, you know, presented in such a way that you don't necessarily pay attention to the importance of it. You know, the fact that she's, pregnant and there's so much else going on that you're not thinking about. Did she hurt her head? You know, mm-hmm. It's amazing. That moment is so great. I mean, we're talking about many, many great moments in the movie, but that moment, of course, is why so many of us, you know, are going to watch it in 20 years.
Yeah. No, I really do love that. Mark, what about you? What's your favorite scene?
Well, I appreciate this movie for many different facets, not the least of which is that it might be the best Seattle-based horror movie since the original The Ring. And because I love my family in Seattle, I love touring, telling jokes up there. And watching this movie, I had no idea, and I don't know if it's real. I think it is. There's like the Seattle Underground Tour that you can take that's like all this like old stuff in Seattle. And so that was interesting from a historical perspective for me. But the turn for me in horror movies is always, when do I stop rooting for the humans in favor of the plot continuing? And because I actually do care about a lot, like there's always one human in a horror movie, you're like, okay, we can axe that one. But then this poor person who's just taking us through the Seattle Underground, like I knew something was going to happen because James Wan is so good at building a mood in a horror movie and kind of letting you know, hey, something bad is right around the corner. But I was kind of pulling for her to survive. And then I'm like, nah, you got to go because I want to see the next scene. I want to get scared again. I want to see the next development. I want to start peeling the layers of this onion back. So I thought that was just the best version of James Wan and the what he does for a horror movie, I think, was in that scene.
No, I think you're right on as far as the James Wan of it, like what he's able to, I think, kick into overdrive when it comes to these, you know, chasing down a hallway scenes. Like just the visual image of the Gabriel character is something that has to be born out of the mind of a master horror maker, because it is borrowing elements of so many different, I would say, like horror movie moments and just doing it so, so very well. The other thing, too, that I think doesn't necessarily get talked about in the mainstream is there's a real like LGBTQ heartbeat in Malignant, Peaches, which I thought this was such a great choice for you, because I talked to a few of my friends and they were like, what's really interesting is like you could absolutely see this written by an LGBTQ filmmaker, because in a certain respect, the Gabriel character is how they feel identity is. Like I could definitely see this being a film that resonated with, you know, people coming out or transitioning or any of that stuff, because there's this moment where it's like the Gabriel character comes out to protect her. She's in a moment of like her worst despair, and this thing that's been living inside her that, whether she realized it or not, in some ways has been saving her. Because as we see this guy beat her up, you think, well, God, if you would have had a baby with him before, you would have been trapped by this man.
You're,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely 100% correct. You know, and I know this may come as a shock to you both, but I don't wake up as Peaches. And I actually look quite different than the glamorous glamazon you see before you. So I definitely have created a character in many ways that is a suit of armor. And I think a lot of queer people, a lot of drag performers, a lot of people who struggle with being in the closet, with hiding parts of themselves, and not just queer people, but, it can speak to all sorts of folks, you know, who have those feelings. But certainly that's a queer narrative. For sure. 100%. The duality, you know, like I often talk to Cassandra Peterson about how the fact is we have lived as two different people, you know, and as it gets longer and longer, you know, she being Elvira and me being Peaches Christ, the lines are really blurred. And this thing started as a fantasy, you know, of darkness and horror. And then it sort of seeps into your regular life. So, no, I think you're right. Malignant definitely speaks to that duality and the closet, quite frankly.
Absolutely. And I also want to correct the record real quick. I said Akilah Green. It's Akilah Cooper. There's two black women genre writers, and they're both named Akilah. Forgive me, sis, but they're spelled differently, but they're two, they have the same name. I'm like, seriously, y'all are making it difficult. But anyway, no, she wrote this one, which I think is interesting too, because I don't know her identity, but like I said, there's just such a like heartbeat of, hey, this thing inside me, which everyone else thinks is wrong, is actually what is probably going to save me from real horrors. And you guys may see it as a horror movie, but I think that's like where we get the like multiple twist endings, because there's so many ways that Gabriel ends up by the end of this movie. And we can sort of like break down that one a little bit more. But I don't know, Mark, for you, what was, I guess you talked about you hadn't seen it before. What do you think the people who hated it were thinking? Do you like have an idea as to what about it they were like not about?
I think that there's, like, anytime you're talking about a film that echoes some Cronenbergian, you know, references and visuals, I think, in a modern era, I think that can throw people for a loop. Mm-hmm. And I think that this movie, if it sets itself up to be like we're chasing this slasher that may or may not be a ghost, that may or may not be alive, and then it turns out to be something really, really different. And so there's curveballs, and then there's like screwballs, you know, like people know how to hit a curveball, but a screwball, a spitball, a forkball, it's like, what the hell is this thing? This was like, you're up at a major league plate and the pitcher throws a wiffle ball and you're like, I have no idea how this is going to get over the plate, but it does, for me anyway. But I think a lot of folks were just kind of, it took a different turn than they were expecting. And I think sometimes people, they do go in with their expectations and they want them met to a certain degree, regardless of whether it's like, I thought this was going to happen and this happened. I think that they at least went in expecting a style of horror movie that they ended up not getting. But part of, I think, the appeal of James Wan making this movie is that I bet James Wan knew this was going to happen. I bet James Wan knew this was not going to please everyone. Mm. And he wanted to do something like Peaches intimated earlier. It's like, this isn't necessarily for the masses. I want the hardcore horror fans to know that I see them and that I'm honoring what we all grew up on.
That's very true. What's interesting is I wonder if he thought, because James Wan has had a ton of horror films that did not do well critically, but had great audience scores. And I don't think it's that different from Malignant, other than the fact of it just leaned in more. So I wonder, like, yeah, it's very interesting to see this, like, as Peaches put it, he very correctly identified what James Wan is in the horror community. He is very out there and people love him because he's brought, I think, horror to a lot of folks who maybe thought that they couldn't do it. But in a certain respect, when you talk to the like hardcore horror heads, they kind of look at him sort of the same way magicians maybe looked at David Copperfield. It's like, yeah, you brought many people over, but like, show us really what, like, show them what it's really about. And maybe this was that. Peaches, as a filmmaker, do you feel some of that in this? Is like James Wan trying to give back to the horror community because maybe that some people saw him a bit of a more commercial?
Yes, 100%. I mean, that's exactly, you know, what I was saying about the score, where, you know, this is the movie that's impressed me the most by him. And it's the movie where I'm like, oh, you are cool, you know? And I think that was like the sort of desired effect was like, there's a confidence to the style and the tone of this film because it's unusual, because it's referencing, you know, Italian cinema and things, you know, in the genre world that are more obscure. If you are, let's say, a more basic horror fan and you go into this movie and you watch that flashback, you know, the movie opens with a big flashback. It is so over the top. It's so camp. You know, it's got a creature in it that you don't understand. It's got really camp performances. The style of it is insane. It almost looks like a comic book in a way. There were probably James Bond fans who were like, nope, this isn't for me. You know, I don't want this. And the other thing is, you know, I commend the lead, I forget her name, but the lead actor's performance, because it's very committed to a strange style of performance. It's almost melodrama. It yeah. almost goes too far. And, you know, I think for a lot of people that those sorts of risks, you know, are too uncomfortable because yeah. they're outside of the wheelhouse of what they're used to. Of course, I loved it. Like, that's actually what made me go, oh, this is great, you mm-hmm. know?
That's an interesting point because Annabelle Wallace playing Madison in this yes. role, I think that the two words you hit on were confidence and then also like a unique style of playing a lead character. The other film genre that I love that you'll see that in is spoof movies, is movies that are sort of not taking themselves seriously by taking themselves and their performances so seriously. And I think that might have been one of the other reasons, Jacqueline, going back to your question about the audience score, maybe why audiences were turned off, because audiences maybe couldn't really tell, is this movie making fun of itself or is this movie taking it seriously? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair question. Enjoyable, whether it is, you know, making fun of itself or whether it's taking everything so seriously. But I think it's a fair question. And sometimes us audiences just want to be able to categorize stuff in a neater box.
Yeah. The last movie I think that put audiences on their heels as far as not letting them know what to think about it, because again, I think people very much knew what they think about it, but definitely not letting them know what they were getting into was probably Cabin in the Woods or the next Drew Goddard film, Bad Times at the Royale or whatever it is, like that, the movie that he did with Hemsworth a little while after that. Both of those movies, also like Crimson Peak is another example. It's like, I just don't know if what was presented is what you think you got at certain points within the narrative. And sometimes audiences just don't forgive you for that, even if the movie that you end up getting is something overall enjoyable. Mother is another example of that, I think. The movie Mother
for sure.
It's funny we brought up Annabelle Wallace because she's like kind of British royalty in the sense, like her family is the Richard Harris, like the first Dumbledore, and Jared Harris from like Chernobyl. Pretty, you know, that's like literally her family. And
very fanfan.
Yeah, very, very that. And she's like done nothing but like big, campy, I would say sort of like she did Silent Night with the kid from Jojo Rabbit. His mom directed that, Camille Griffin Davis. She's now doing this. It's interesting seeing the girl that was basically on pace to be the next Zoe Saldana as far as like being a part of these big genre movies when she got cast alongside Tom Cruise in The Mummy. Because if you look at like a lot of people after that, you know, Rosamund Pike, Rebecca Ferguson, a lot of people when they star alongside Tom Cruise like that can really catapult. And she's kind of gone the other direction. So I don't know. What about you, Peaches? What did you think about her in this? Because she's almost too pretty to be in this kind of a horror movie. And I say that with like every ounce of humility to say is it's just like, this is just such a gruff and tumble thing. They honestly don't like people that have the look that she has. And this,
are you saying she's too pretty to have a head inside of her, Jacqueline?
No, it's kind of that. Like, and maybe that was the dichotomy. Maybe that's the point. Make this like model-like figure get destroyed. But it was a choice, her casting.
I think it was, because I actually, I'm not a big fan of having supermodels play scream queens, which of course, you know, was something that like became popular in the 90s and 2000s. When I was casting All About Evil, I remember, you know, the casting director kept bringing me people for leads. And I'm like, you know, not that Natasha Lyonne isn't gorgeous. She is. But, you know, I grew up with Shelley Duvall and The Shining, you know, Sissy Spacek and Carrie, you know, women that looked real, you know, and unique. And so when this started again, I had this expectation of like kind of a little bit of an eye roll, you know, of, okay, she's gorgeous, you know. But by the end of the movie, I was like, oh, I get it, because it auto worked with your, it messed with your expectations. And so, you know, when you discover that she's actually, you know, also hideous and terrifying and, you know, and that scene in the jail cell, you know, just so incredible, you know, where they put her in that environment. And I think it was brilliant. I think, he used your expectations against you, and it paid off. You know, we were all duped in a way. And she's brilliant. I actually loved her performance. At the beginning of the film, again, I was kind of like, is this good? Like, what is happening here? You know, what is going on? Is this melodrama? Like, I don't get it, you know? And by the end of the movie, I was like, oh, it's genius. You know, she was wonderful. And we were all just played like a fiddle.
And I love that conversation that she has with Sydney when they're talking about her being adopted and that sort of revelation. Mm-hmm. I think that's a powerful moment in the film for me. And I think that that's a sort of a touchstone moment for audiences. Like if you are now, if you weren't rooting for these characters before, I don't know how that scene hits you, but that definitely locked me into caring about them as people and wanting to see this thing through, wanting to see exactly what the hell is going on. But Jacqueline, also on the performance note, at least for me in horror movies, I need some sort of anchor point where I feel like somebody's on the same page as me, especially when it's a mystery that's evolving. And I thought both of the detectives in this movie, George Young and Nicole Brianna White, I believe are the names of the performers. I thought they were tremendous as far as like, they're a couple steps behind, so am I. The three of us should be friends.
Yeah, no, I really did dig them. I will say even more than digging them though, the sister, was anyone else immediately suspicious of her because she's basically a Disney adult?
Yes.
Like immediately I was like, this bitch is gaslighting her somehow. She's poisoning her food. Like, and that is another example of how well this was written with red herrings. There are red herrings all over this movie because really when you think about it, it's a pretty basic plot. It's a standard embedded presence movie. Like we've seen tons of these. I mean, in a certain way, The Fly is an example of this, right? You know what I mean? Like these, like something is inside me and it's turning me into a monster, metamorphosis type stuff. So once you have, I think that, you kind of have to play with it a lot to make it seem fresh and interesting. And this movie literally from frame one was like, you are not gonna know what this movie is. And by the time you know it, you're gonna be so just shocked by the fact that we brought you here. You're not gonna question the fact that it is the most basic plot ever. That is my biggest complaint, I would say, with some people, if you're like a horror head that didn't like it. When you strip away some of the bells and whistles, really, this girl hit her head and the demon inside her awoke.
Yeah.
That's it. Everything else is a red herring that led you to that very simple sentence. And if you knew or were clued into any of that before the third act, you wouldn't like the movie as much, I think. You would call it basic. So I don't know. Like, next time, just write a basic idea and then hide it.
Just hide it deep inside your cerebral cortex. Put it right next to the hypothalamus, just where Gabriel was resting for a long time. I also don't hate the idea of Jacqueline, you as a sleuth in another life, because anytime there's a murder under mysterious circumstances, you're going to want to question any adult who enjoys theme parks a little too much in the immediate area to see what they were doing at the time of question.
I think the audience will bear me out. Whatever. I have some... I say this like I was like, I have a friend who's an alcoholic, but I have a friends who are Disney adults and I don't have anything against
them. You and I
them.
Have the, some of the same friends that are
Disney
adults.
Yeah, we have some of the same friends who are Disney adults. And I'm talking like built careers around being Disney adult people. So trust me when I say if you have a Disney adult in your life as a normal person, it is nothing compared to our friends that are on YouTube. But
hey,
I will
the Dole Whip
this.
Is great. The Dole Whip is fantastic.
We love them, but I do have to admit, anybody showing up in a princess costume anywhere, I'm going to look at you twice, three times. I don't care if it's your job.
I assumed that was her job.
It is her job, but she showed up in it. And people that do that for a job don't show up in it after they leave. Like, that's a uniform.
No,
she's in it outside of work.
Yeah. No, there was part of me. So I have some friends in San Francisco who make a living, you know, they're drag performers, but they do like dress up as, you know, Peter Pan or Jack Sparrow or whatever and do like children's parties. And they have these little businesses where you can hire them to show up at a birthday party. I assumed that's what she was. And in the panic of getting there on time, she couldn't take, because of course I was like looking at the scene going, really? No. No, you're not going to go to the hospital and that, you know. But yeah, like I agree with you. I do want to say though, thinking about your analysis of the movie, that one thing about this film that's interesting is it's both that sort of body horror, you know, the monster within, the Fly, the Cronenberg of it all, but also he very effectively, or Kayla, you know, Cooper, very effectively did make giallo film, because the real, you know, mystery of it, you know, a great giallo film has that mystery. It's really a mystery film, right?
Yeah.
And the fact is, I was totally hooked and like, what is this? Who is this? Why is this happening? What's going on? And you think that you can figure it out based on, you know, your knowledge of genre. And it tricked me. And, you know, when that woman is, you know, up in the attic and all the different things that they did. You think it's going this direction. And I have to give credit to Kayla Cooper. That screenplay was solid. I mean, it moves. Yeah. You're never bored. And it's a mystery film.
Well, I mean, I have to ask you about your film too, because the thing I will say with that is you have to be a study of the art form to parody it. You have to be a study of the art form to subvert it or to expand it. And honestly, in horror, just to get through, get by, have a film that somebody like Shudder says, hey, we want to put you up. You also have to do those things. So talk about your approach with your film and more importantly, how you got Natasha Lyonne to sign up for All About Evil.
Okay. Well, I was running movies in a movie theater. I was a manager of a movie theater. And as Peaches, I did a midnight movie series, a cult movie event called Midnight Mass. And the writing was on the wall, like single screen movie theaters in San Francisco and across the country were closing down all around us. And so my anxiety around losing these old movie theaters is what led me to create the story of what should we do to in order to save these, you know, movie houses. And, you know, the answer in my movie is murder, I guess. That's what drove it. But the movies I was sending up were old grindhouse exploitation films, the films of Rachel Gordon Lewis, especially, and Ted B. Michaels. But really, there was a woman, Doris Wishman, who made these movies and said, if men can do it, I can do it too. Why should they exploit women and make all the money? I can exploit women too. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. I thought, oh, that's so twisted and awesome. And really this weird kind of feminism in a way. And so I was lucky that I had a director of photography who shot the movie, The Slums of Beverly Hills, Tom Richmond, who's brilliant. He's shot so many amazing movies. And he said, well, we're still without a Deborah, my lead. He said, who's your first choice? I said, God, if I could have anybody, it would be Natasha Lyonne. And he pulls out his cell phone and calls her up and says, I'm sitting with this filmmaker and I think you'd like his script, and hands her the phone. And I start to pitch her the movie and start to explain who Doris Wishman is. And before I can get her name out of my mouth, Natasha interrupts me and says, oh, Doris Wishman. And I'm like, oh, you know who Doris Wishman is? Wow. And she says, oh, I know Doris. And I'm like, okay, you have to read my script. You have to read my script, you know. And she did. And then she signed on to do the movie. And Natasha, well, big movie star. Even when she did my movie, she had already done all the American Pie movies. But I'm a cheerleader in this. But she's New York, and she's grown up with drag queens. She already was in Die Mommy Die with Charles Bush and drag. Yeah. And she was in Party Monster. Like, yep. Many actors would have been afraid to work with me, you know, and she actually was like, oh, no, that's a credit to you that you're a drag queen.
Well, because she knew before RuPaul's Drag Race proved to everyone, drag performers, yeah. It's always the funniest thing in the world when I see these people, they're like, maybe they see a performer on a show and then they see them later be like, oh my God, she's really talented. I'm like, 'cause that's TV. And anyone who is working as a drag performer 5 nights a week has developed a repertoire. It's like anybody working as a comic for 20 years like Mark. Yeah, he knows how to handle a heckler. You're not going to throw him anything. Like a drag queen handles bridesmaids drunk on a Friday evening and gets them in and out. He can handle a grip on an attitude. She can handle a grip on an attitude. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's why I love watching We're Here. It's because it really does show the performance aspect of just barnstorming a town, showing up and being like, we're going to give you the best show you've ever seen. And then just the comic in me is watching it and just thinking about all the elements that I think of when I go to a town that isn't necessarily, you know, housing an improv, where it's just sort of, okay, this is how the stand-up works. It's like you have to set everything up yourself. And I also got feelings of that, though, Peach, is watching this movie, just because it does act as sort of a love letter to those movie theaters that aren't the big multiplexes. Like, you know, if I want to go see Top Gun Maverick, I'm probably going IMAX, Dolby, whatever. But sometimes those smaller theaters are the ones where you want to go see a horror movie, where you want to feel creeped out with a packed house. And so I definitely felt the love of those style movie theater, like the New Beverly, I guess you would say, in LA. That's sort of the vibe I got watching this movie.
100%. I mean, 100%. And yeah, all of that stuff. I mean, you know, drag queens and stand-up comedians, have a lot in common. Exotic dancers, a lot in common. Like, we are in the trenches. We know how to handle shit. You know, we don't buckle under pressure. And, you know, that those skills, like you said, can translate very well on a movie set, you know, and it, you do not want a director who's going to not be able to handle stress.
Not going to be able to handle stress and handle it effectively. It's like, yeah, anybody can handle stress and throw something through a wall. But like, the idea right. is being able to handle stress in a productive manner. Again, I use the drunk bridesmaids is a perfect example, because there's nothing you really want to get more escalated than a group of drunk women thinking they're entitled to a good time. But if you can de-escalate
that. For both drag
that,
performers and comedians.
And that, comedians. That oh my God, yeah. You guys, I feel like this should have just been the two of you complaining
this
about.
This is a therapy session for Peaches and
the yeah, women yeah, yeah. that come and invade your various shows and make them difficult. Peaches, we could talk about this forever, but I definitely want to talk about the film in the sense of the moment that horror is having and the moment that I would say performers like Natasha have in it. Because I think like she, more than anyone, when I, and I say this and I hope that people will take offense, she is someone that lives in drag in the sense that she very much lives her life in a certain level of performance. And I think it is authentic. And I would say that there's a lot of people that do that. John Waters is an example of this. John is just being John Waters, but he lives his life in drag. And as much so as Shangela or you, Peaches. But talk about how that moment is that the horror moment is having too. Like, who are these people that are sort of like living their life in horror? And like, how are you guys are finding each other on places like Shudder?
Wow. That is okay. Jacqueline, I have to commend you, because as someone who grew up obsessed with John Waters and is now friends with John Waters, I've tried to describe that. Like, Cassandra, Elvira and I can go out into the world out of drag and not be recognized. Now, John, you know, he has that pencil thin mustache. He has that style. Natasha has that hair, you know, and the voice and the, you know, the wry wit. And you're right. They kind of embody living as a character, and it is authentic. They are those people, you know. But when I go out with John, you know, if John and I go to lunch, I mean, no one, especially if it's San Francisco or New York or something, like no one can take their eyes off him, you know, because he's sitting there in the room. And Natasha is the same way. And yeah, I think that the interesting thing about Natasha for me has been how much of her actual persona, you know, the actual Natasha is so bizarre and so wonderfully, you know, I mean, she plays a crazy character in my movie. I'm like, oh yeah, but that's nothing like hanging out with Natasha, you know. Natasha's, you know, just one of the wildest, most unique. She's literally one of the smartest, if not the smartest people I've ever met. You know, she's just, you know, genius. And yeah, I think this moment that we're having as far as communities like Shudder, and I'm a fan of Shudder. Like, before Shudder, you know, kind of embraced me, everyone's tried a horror network, right? Like, we've seen this over and over again. All About Evil originally was on a network called Chiller, which was NBC Universal's version of Shudder. I have to say, Sam Zimmerman and AMC have done such an incredible job with Shudder that if you're not paying whatever that low rate is, it's like $5 or $6 a month, like, do yourself a favor. It is so well curated. And then the fact that, like, I'm on Dragula, which is on Shudder. Yeah. I'm in a series called Behind the Monsters, which is on Shudder. I'm in the Scream Queen documentary, which is on Shudder. Like, I am thrilled that All About Evil ended up at Shudder, because that's really where the audience for All About Evil is the Shudder audience.
No, I really do love that. And I hope folks will definitely, if you don't have a subscription, grab that free trial. Trust me, you will not want to cancel it afterwards. You will find your next great watch. And it is a perfect horror great gateway drug. Think of that as your first hit. get Shudder, watch All About Evil, and then just keep going. Peaches, this has been so great to chat with you about this film and your just love of horror. And thank you for making me watch Malignant, because I will have to admit here now, I had not seen it before we were doing this, and I thank you for giving me that moment.
You were giving me crap for being like, Mark, when did you first discover? You hadn't even seen it.
No, I hadn't. But this is the difference. I saved mine to the end.
Yep. Nope. You're better at this than I am.
Because that is what a petty girl will do. And I learned that from a gay man like everyone else.
Perfect. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. All right, everyone. That, of course, was Peaches Christ, filmmaker and drag performer. You can check out All About Evil, starring Natasha Lyonne, on Shudder right now. That was so much fun, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and, you know, thinking about that first scene where we meet Madison's sister, and then, you know, Peaches talking about growing up in an area where you'd have a lot of performers in drag just, like, walking around doing normal things. I kind of come from a similar background because I spent part of my formative years in Colonial Williamsburg, where you'll see, like, the old-timey, like, blacksmith and stuff, and they're just at Food Lion. Yeah. They're just filling up gas. And it's like, well, okay. And so it's just kind of something you accept over time. So maybe that's why I just didn't really bat an eye. And I didn't assume that this Disney adult was out to murder her adopted sister.
No, and like maybe, and again, maybe this says something about me, because immediately I was like, basically anyone who is too into anything, I worry about you. That's it. That's it. Yeah. I just worry about you. But it turns out she was great. And I was putting some of my own biases in that, which we don't want folks to do. We want them to come here and argue about it on Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. That's why we have this podcast.
It's a safe space.
But as amazingly that as that is in this fun safe space, I cannot believe I'm going to say this, but we're approaching our 100th episode, y'all. We've done this 100 times. We've done it more than that. Y'all just haven't seen all of it. But we've definitely done it at least 100 times, and our anniversary for that is coming up. So in honor of that, we want you guys to go ahead and send us a quick clip, maybe 30 seconds to 1 minute, telling us your favorite movie that you think Rotten Tomatoes is wrong about. I've literally been doing this for an entire year. You can do it for 30 seconds, because if you are passionate enough, we definitely want to include you in our 100th episode, which is coming up soon. So get your videos together and then just email us anything you want us to cover, you know, at Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. And wherever you're listening to this or watching this, be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and tell your friends. Mark, what do we have coming up next week?
We are switching gears into the world of television, streaming TV, in this particular case, talking about, you know, how the MCU is like all those big movies. Well, there's also streaming shows, and they're gaining in popularity, and a lot of people love talking about them. They kicked off with WandaVision. Now we have Ms. Marvel and She-Hulk coming out later on this year. And so there's a lot of MCU TV to discuss. We're going to be ranking our favorite to least favorite. Where are you going, Loki? Where do you think you're going?
Where do you
all
think
that
you're
more?
Going?
Yeah.
What's the next
week?
What's the next show that's coming out?
I believe it's going to be, now that we have Ms. Marvel underway, I think She-Hulk is in August.
She-Hulk is in August. All right, so we're gonna get ahead before She-Hulk. Everything up until then. All right, folks, tune in for that next week, and we'll see you next time on Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong.